Where do you go to get name brand music at a fraction of retail cost? All songs considered.
So, you know, there are so many things that public radio is, right?
Yeah.
Caring journalism, we got that, right?
Yeah.
Perspective, I learn a lot all the time I listen. But the one thing I think we do, joy.
Yeah.
I think we've asked for money four times in our 18, 19-year history, right?
Right.
So this matters.
So here's what you do. Go to donate.npr.org/allsongs, donate.npr.org/allsongs, and make an investment in the future of this show. And when you give to the public radio system, you are telling them that the little bit of joy that we try to bring into the world matters to you.
Right. So giving to your station supports what we do as well as supports what your station doesn't. And that's a beautiful thing. And that's like 18 years of All Songs Considered. That's 800 tiny desk concerts. Bands, musicians, they trust NPR. That's why they take a chance and play like in an office in the daytime. And that trust and that credibility lets them take chances with us.
So when you support public radio, you're saying that truth matters, that the honesty matters, that credibility matters to you. And when you support public radio, you're saying that these conversations that we have about music matter to you and the companionship you get through the podcast matter to you. So again, it's donate.npr.org/allsongs.
Thank you! I'm Bob Boylan with All Songs Considered. Jeff Tweedy has written a book that's incredibly open-hearted and honest. Let's Go So We Can Get Back, a memoir of recording and discording with Wilco, etc., is a journey in music, friendship, and family. From getting his first guitar, which didn't work out so well, to the formation of Uncle Tupelo with his friend Jay Farrar and their surprising breakup, to the various incarnations of Wilco and stories of insecurities, drug dependency, and thoughtful reflections. On this edition of All Songs Considered, a conversation with Jeff Tweedy, including clips from his Penguin Random House audiobook and some thoughts on his new solo album called Warm, which addresses an awful lot of personal thoughts and felt to me like a companion to his book. A few years ago, when I talked to Jeff Tweedy for a book I wrote called Your Song Changed My Life, he said something about being in a band that stuck with me. He said his image of band life was shaped by the Monkees, both the TV show and their music. He said, and I quote him here, that a band is supposed to live together and have madcap adventures together. And so I begin the conversation with the Monkees' mid-60s hit, Last Train to Clarksville.
Don't be slow. No, 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 no. 'Cause I'm leaving in the morning and I must see you again. We'll have one more night together.
What's cooking in your mind?
Just how incredible that still sounds.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all the best musicians in LA at the time, probably.
Right, and for those who don't know, it's the Monkees, it's Last Train to Clarksville, it's probably 65, I can't remember precisely, but I'll guess that, but you probably heard it a little later than that.
Yeah, I heard it on reruns on TV, and 45s that my sister and my aunt collected.
Right, and for those who don't know, the Monkees were, a put-together band, we'll just say, and had a TV show that was sort of reminiscent, if anybody's seen A Hard Day's Night, sort of reminiscent of a lifestyle of being in a band, which is sort of why I wanted to play this and talk to you about being in a band. And
yeah, I realized when I was writing the book that everything in my life has actually kind of come full circle to my daydream of what the Monkees life must be like.
Describe that for people who don't know what that
means. Well, it's a collective of fun people that make music and live together and are funny and smart and have madcap antics and that part I don't know if it's really played out, but the part where they all live together and have access to each other's musicianship at all times so that, you know, they can have emergency jam sessions.
Zany is also a word that comes to mind.
I think that, yeah, the main thing I think I talk about in my book is just the appeal of having a clubhouse, basically, like a musical clubhouse, which is, you know, Hard Day's Night and Help. And the Monkees all established that in my mind pretty, maybe it's like a little kid going to see, well, actually, to be honest, this is a crazy thing that I did myself. I went to see Rocky and I came home and I knocked myself out with the doorknob because I thought it was cool to have a black eye.
Whoa.
So
you're quite a handful.
Yeah. No, so it's just like a maybe a somewhat unhealthy ability to live in a fantasy world.
So the fantasy world you go and wind up in bands. You want to just talk about your madcap experiences at the outset and how these things unfold, and which you talk so much about in the book.
It didn't turn out to be exactly the way I pictured it.
but the good times were not to last.
Yeah, in high school, you know, Jay Farrar and Mike Heidorn and I started playing with one of Jay's brothers. We had a band. We actually played a lot of 60s music because we were kind of interested in psychedelia and garage band music and what we thought of as the original punk rock music after we had discovered punk rock and kind of traced the lineage back to the Seeds and the Sonics and things like that. So I don't know, early on, you know, we were in high school, and then eventually Uncle Tupelo all lived together, but it didn't resemble the Monkees' house, really. We didn't have a Hollywood set designer, for one.
I'm a big fan of audiobooks, especially when the author reads the book, and so I pulled a couple of clips from your book. I'll play during this conversation. I want to start with this one. I think it's sort of self-explanatory. This is just after you've realized that Jay Farrar has left Uncle Tupelo, but it also describes some of your living conditions here. Here we go.
The furniture, which was already second or third hand by the time we dragged it in, looked and smelled like we kept raccoons as pets. There were pizza boxes stacked to the ceiling, and garbage bags filled with dirty dishes that deserved a decent burial. There were more blankets hanging over doorways than actual doors, and a fridge that contained little more than beer and ketchup. I sat there for days and stewed. When you've committed yourself to stewing and watching the front door, you have a lot of extra time for taking an inventory of your life. I started to put the pieces together, thinking back over the last year, and with hindsight, it all seemed so obvious. Some of the clues were right there in the songs. I thought Chickamauga was about a Civil War battlefield, and maybe it mostly was, but there was another layer that was clearly foreshadowing. Solitude is where I'm bound. Ugh, how did I miss that? If the record was a conversation between us, I was all, "We'll get there eventually," and he was, "The time is right for getting out while we still can." I was also starting to take stock of our shared space. Both Jay and I were 26, deep enough into what could fairly be described as adulthood. We had a major label record deal. Shouldn't our living conditions not be best described as camping? Things that I'd never noticed before suddenly came front and center. Why is there a garbage bag filled with dirty dishes? I thought. Whose idea was that?
Oh my gosh. When I was in a band, we practiced at the basement of the 930 Club, and it was all like rat infested in my gear. It was just so much humidity, and I could just, the idealized world of the Monkees just keep coming back to me, and I don't know why I'm obsessed with that, but.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, I'm still kind of thinking about why there was a garbage bag filled with dirty dishes. I mean, my best guess is that somebody just got tired of looking at them in the sink and thought maybe we should just start over.
But the sitting and thinking about your bandmate and your relationship with Jay Farrar maybe is actually a more important place to head toward. You guys were able to create pretty remarkable stuff, and yet you were really different people.
Yeah, I mean, one of the nice things about writing a book is you get to answer questions that no one ever asks you. And I felt like, you know, that's a particularly, I don't know, unpleasant memory at the very end of Uncle Tupelo. But writing the book, I was able to talk a little bit more than I've ever been able to about how much Jay and I loved each other. I mean, or at least I loved him. You know, I think that he changed my life, and he helped me learn how to play the guitar. We shared a lot of information about records and spent an awful lot of time together, kind of trying to figure things out about music and how to be in a band and what other people's music meant to us. And so I hope that comes across in the book as much as my side of some of the more tumultuous times.
I think that was one of the more remarkable things about reading, or I should say I listened to the audiobook, which I madly loved your reading, because the honesty shines through. But your both critical eye and your honest appreciation for these people who you had at times conflict with was kind of beautiful.
Well, I mean, I'm a lot older now, so it's a little bit easier to look back with some clarity, and it's easy to be generous when you do take stock and acknowledge that, you know, that was the first step I took on this path to where I am in my life. And I feel pretty fortunate with the way my life has turned out, in spite of there being conflict, in spite of there being some struggles and some suffering. I really don't have a lot to complain about. I don't have a lot of scores to settle. I don't have an axe to grind with anyone, really.
I was thinking about what you each got from each other as friends, and more particularly about songwriting. I want to play a clip from the book about songwriting, and maybe you can tell me what it is that Jay or anyone else has helped you in terms of shaping the way you write songs and what you write about and how you write about them. Let me play this clip from the book.
Jay and I had vastly different approaches to lyric writing. He was always zoomed out by a power of 10 to a height that outlined the edges of a big picture I could never quite make out from where I stood. You could sum up the creative worldviews in that first demo cassette we put out in 87, shortly after we changed our name to Uncle Tupelo, colorblind and rhymeless. Jay has a song on there called Before I Break, which is about a guy drinking himself to death and losing any hope to even see beyond tomorrow, and he ends up half drunk in a ditch by the side of the road. Me, on the other hand, I contributed Screen Door, which is about wearing loose clothes because it's too hot, skipping school and playing songs with your friends on the front porch. Jay was pretty much fully formed right out of the gate. He had a gift for lyricism and an authentically great voice that made everything he sang sound like the Old Testament. My voice, on the other hand, sounded like the kind of pubescent warble one might hear squeaking through an Appalachian fast food drive-through speaker. When I hear those early recordings, I'm just mortified. I used to chew tobacco, and crazy as it sounds, in an effort to quit, I started smoking, which is a stupid way to quit chewing tobacco, but I thought it would at least add some grit to my voice. No such luck. Now I was a pubescent hillbilly with a chest cold. Yeah.
There's that.
Yeah. I think the key to it really was sharing records and sharing inspiration. I don't remember thinking that I had to write in the same type of language or style as Jay was writing. I felt like I needed to write about the same world Jay was writing about. But I think fairly early on, I was conscious that it was probably a little bit, not necessarily comic relief, but at least some contrast, some shading about the same world, you know? I really did feel like that. Like the darkness was darker and the lightness was lighter. Like for whatever, the light was brighter. If I was thinking about it being a band with two points of view.
Did you ever, in this collaboration or other collaborations, have more back and forth as opposed to the Jay song and then the Jeff song? He ever help you with words or vice versa or?
No, it was pretty separate, to be honest. The songs themselves, the ones I sing in general are the ones I wrote, and the ones Jay sings are the ones he wrote. I think we credited each other as writers on everything early on because we would arrange everything together. And to us at that time, that felt a lot more like songwriting than arranging. Because a lot of the music we listened to, like the Minutemen and, you know, punk rock records, the stops and starts were the thing that was most exciting to us, you know. And that's kind of not as essential to how someone would think about a song, but it was how we thought about songs then.
My experience in being in bands is sometimes no one talks to one another, because that's the one of the beauties of music, is that you don't really have to have a conversation, but there are eye contacts or stares or something. I know for me that improved me when my guitar player would look at me when I play a synth line, and it was like, really? Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if that sort of nonverbal, like you sing something and, because you respect this man, if you ever got stare downs or vice versa happen where really you're going to sing that, or that helped you become better at what you do?
Yes and no. I mean, I think that one of the things I learned early on and what really appreciated about my friendship with Jay was that we were, you know, maybe he was maybe the only person I had to listen to music with that the music would still sound good. Do you know, like a lot of other people, if I tried to share a Gang of Four record with them, for example, at that point in time, any other friend I might have had would have started talking or started doing something else, or not understood that it was an activity in and of itself in my mind. Jay and I shared that and shared our ability to listen to music together and be still and be with it, you know. At the same time, playing music with Jay, he was, you know, I understand what you're talking about when you describe nonverbal cues and communication. That's definitely a part of music and how it all works. But Jay was often so difficult to read that I just assumed he hated everything I was doing all the time. So maybe it forced me to learn how to do a little bit of my own, you know, self-evaluation, you know, with a little bit more self-confidence than, and ironically, it kind of creates a little bit more of a insulated evaluation.
There are a few exchanges in the book with your son, Sammy, with your son, Spencer, and another with your wife, Susie, Sue Miller. And I was taken by the honesty and the openness that happens and unfolds in this book. And I think it gave me insight to someone whose music I certainly listened to, waiting for new albums to come out. But then that veil of, there's a whole life behind that that we never see. And it's one of the reasons that the book was so impactful for me. So I'd like to play this clip of you and your wife.
Can you just leave me out of it?
Completely? I don't think so.
I don't see how it's anybody's business. Just write about your songs or whatever. Don't bring me up at all.
I think it'd be nice to include a few things.
Like what? You're going to make me sound awful.
Are you kidding? No, no, not at all. It's all going to be positive and funny.
Funny how?
You want to see my imitation of you?
Oh, God.
Trust me, it's good. Here, I'll show you. Is that how it's going to sound?
That's supposed to be me listening to your music?
Yeah. Nailed it.
How about when I got cancer 9 months after we started dating?
Maybe. Is that a positive story?
It has a happy ending. I had this pain in my chest, and I told everybody at LoungeX, I have a tumor. And they were like, no, no, relax, it's nothing. You just need to stretch more. But then I went and got x-rays, and the doctor told me, you have a tumor, all right? Big tumor right there in your chest, but it's benign, so it's not going to kill you. We'll just cut it out.
They sawed you in half.
They cracked my fucking chest open to take out the tumor, and the doctor was like, whoopsies, looks like it was cancer, but we got it, so you're fine now.
Was I helpful during any of that?
Yes, and you were, what, 23 at the time? Not an emotionally mature age for most guys. I think that's what turned my parents around. That's when they decided they liked you.
What's your age difference?
10 years. Uh-huh. I wish that the original recording of that conversation might have been available or usable sonically, because that sounds like a high school play or something.
This was the roller coaster of the book for me, which was I loved reading about your relationships with your musicians and that you work with and how you came to write songs. All interesting, and I like that stuff okay. But then there was this whole other layer of understanding that the people whose songs you listen to have deep lives, and yours was quite the roller coaster. Both I can play one more thing, which was a bit about your issues with pain and pain medications, but let me do that just after this quick break. I'm talking with Jeff Tweedy about his new book, Let's Go So We Can Get Back, and you're listening to All Songs Considered from NPR Music.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company. In 1980, with a few thousand dollars and used dairy equipment, Ken Grossman founded Sierra Nevada Brewing Company. Ken's award-winning ales propelled him from home brewer to craft brewer. Today, Ken and his family still own 100% of the company, one of the most successful independent craft breweries in America. More at sierranevada.com. Support also comes from MailChimp. It might sound like MailChimp just does email marketing, but they actually do a lot more to help your business grow. Because growth doesn't just look one way, MailChimp helps guide you to the right marketing decisions for your business, from audience management to ad campaigns and automation. MailChimp, they do more than mail.
I'm Bob Boylan. I'm here with Jeff Tweedy. We're talking about his book called Let's Go So We Can Get Back, a memoir of recording and discording with Wilco, etc. Part of this journey has to do with dealing with pain, your migraines, for one. And yet, I saw you many, many times on stage, and God knows, and I don't mean just me, I mean your fans, your people who love you. And how to muster through some of that stuff. The other day we were supposed to have a conversation. You had a migraine. These are things you've been dealing with your whole life. And it somehow, I don't know how you've managed to sort of plow through some of the things that that unfolded in the book.
Yeah. You know, I think I kind of come to the conclusion that it's maybe the example of my, you know, my parents having, my mother suffered from migraines and my father suffered probably, with a lot of undiagnosed mood disorders similar to mine. And they both worked really hard. They never missed work. They did everything they needed to do. I showed up for stuff that, well, my dad might not have showed up for stuff as much as my mother did in terms of like our family life, but he showed up for work, that's for sure. So I think that was the most prominent modeled behavior in my life growing up. I never really knew anything other than that. You know, I didn't know it wasn't what you're supposed to do. I wasn't given many options about not getting through the end of the school day, even if I was sick, you know. But then I ended up missing a lot of school anyway, because it was just beyond being able to plow through.
How do you deal with your migraines? I see you sometimes wearing a hat on stage to block lighting, but I mean, What do you do when it's 8:30, 9 o'clock and you have a migraine and you're going to go on stage and make loud noise? I don't understand how you do that.
Well, there have been moments, and this is what I kind of hope for, the best case scenario, as I get through a few songs and the mind over matter kind of takes over and I am in a meditative state enough to stay inside the music, and it becomes, it's actually healed me before, to be honest. It's a crazy kind of counterintuitive thing that would help somebody with a migraine, but it has happened. So that's my best hope by the time it's time to go on stage. And then there have been many, many nights where it is just everything I can do to get to the end of the show, you know, and I've really prided myself on the fact that I've hardly ever cut a show short. There's been a few times, but never cut it so short that somebody would even notice that it was cut short, you know?
Down from two to an hour and 40 minutes instead of 2 hours plus.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Amazing. I want to play this clip, mainly talk about drugs and music. And I had got an email from somebody who was really interested in knowing whether there is any sort of organization that helps musicians with addiction. And this is all while I'm reading your book and thinking about your book and about to talk to you. And so is there anything that, because it's so prevalent?
I think that there are a couple of organizations. There's definitely a Grammy organization called Music Cares that I think might apply to a broader health issues, not necessarily just addiction, but I think, you know, a lot of musicians don't have health insurance. And I mean, the thing I always tell people is if you wanted to help people, if, you know, you consider this an epidemic, which it is, not just with musicians, then you should advocate for universal health care. Because it's a health problem.
Yeah. Just thinking about the way you were thinking, I'm going to play a clip about A Ghost Is Born and how you looked at it as perhaps something you would be leaving for your children to help them sort out who you were. Hang on, here it comes.
The worst of it happened when I was alone in my hotel room having panic attacks. Taking too many pills and then panicking because I'd taken too many pills. Every night I'd lie in bed or just as often in the tub until the bath water would get cold, telling myself, if I fall asleep right now, there's a pretty good chance I'm not waking up. People die in this situation all the time. My internet search history alone was a cry for help. Page after page basically asking Google, am I going to die? I was a goner. But I didn't have to lose everything. A Ghost Is Born would be a gift to my kids, who could turn to it when they were older and put together the pieces of me a little bit more than I'd been able to put myself together for them in real life. There will be a new day someday, I thought, and I wanted this record to be an elemental tool for Spencer and Sammy to reconstruct my worldview, to have some deeper connection to the dad they'd lost. Grim stuff, I know. And more than a little maudlin. Looking back, I didn't think my kids would be able to reconstruct a surrogate father or that they were going to be parented by an album. I just wanted them to know I cared about them if I wasn't around anymore.
That's pretty sad stuff.
It is, and I assume that they've read and know and think about how old might Sammy and Spencer have been.
So it's like two and six.
I don't even know what the question is, Jeff. I just feel this stuff, and I think about what it must mean to your children now to read that and understand who their father is. And have they talked to you about it?
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about it at length. We've definitely talked about their addiction a lot because it runs in their family. They have a genetic predisposition, and I want them to have as much information as they can have. They both have explored the Wilco catalog pretty extensively. And oddly enough, without knowing a lot of that information, they both have gravitated towards A Ghost Is Born, which is kind of interesting. Sammy in particular, really, that's far and away his favorite Wilco record. And when he learned all of this stuff recently, the things that are in the book, he was kind of astonished, you know, that it made it resonate that much more for him.
What do you think is a songwriter's relationship? An old question, but pain and songwriting, it's such a fuel for writing songs, and yet it's also your attempt to be able to not have that pain and try to get away from that.
I have a lot of strong opinions about the tortured artist myth and artist's relationship with pain and suffering. And in my opinion, the mistaken notion that art grows out of pain, I think it's a little bit backwards from there. I feel like everybody has pain in their life. Everyone suffers. If art grew out of suffering alone, there'd be a lot more art. You know, there'd be a lot more, there'd be a lot more people creating art. And a lot of really true horrific suffering on this planet is done by people in positions where they don't have the means of production of any type of art. Their daily struggle is survival. So I resent it being portrayed that way on their behalf, yeah. You know, just as a person that just like is aware of that. And I can't bring myself to embrace that notion just simply because of that. But I will say what happens is because there's so much suffering, because everybody has a certain amount of pain in their life, and because people struggle, it's part of the human condition. When people recognize that in someone's art, it adds value to it. And that's what I think happens more than it being the impetus for great art. I think it's just that art becomes great when people are able to see themselves and recognize themselves in it. And unfortunately, one of the most shared experiences for humans is sadness and suffering. And at the very least, it's one of our experiences that seems to require more reflection. And we seem to be wired to focus on it a little bit more, maybe because we're trying to figure out how to avoid it. But happiness and a lot of other emotions, we don't spend much time unpacking. You know, we don't really need to introspect joy. We just like hope there's more of it, you know. And certainly a lot of music is created out of joy and is created in an effort to bring joy to the performer, right. You know, not to go on a tirade. I just feel like that's my perspective.
Has it, you found it a helpful thing? Like when you write a song that gets to a crux of something that you've been thinking of, is it a release or is it magnify or is it just an expression and on you go with the same pain and the same feeling you had before you wrote the thing? And true of the book too. I mean, it was the book, although you're older now and it's a little different, was the book helpful to write and to put things in perspective and make you a better human?
Well, the content of my songs and the content of the book, I think you have to introspect, and I guess thinking about things and trying to weigh them and make sense of them and explain them to other people in this case of the book. I guess that's all helpful, but none of that is as helpful as the general act of creating for me is the most therapeutic and helpful, you know, sustaining activity in my life for as long as I can remember. So it doesn't really matter what I'm writing about if I'm able to kind of disappear in the process of making something.
One of the beautiful pieces of advice in the book for anybody who's doing any sort of writing at all is don't sit there and wait for the muse. Just work at it, right?
Yeah. You're gonna write a lot fewer songs, a lot fewer poems, you know, a lot fewer books if you sit around and wait for a bolt of lightning, I think. Yeah, I think you should put the pencil in your hand, put the guitar on your lap, and get to work. And that's generally, from my experience, that's where the inspiration actually comes from, is that you have connected yourself to, I don't know, a lightning rod. You know, if you connect, to keep the metaphor going, you've connected yourself to something that attracts inspiration.
And if you don't go fly a kite... It ain't happening.
Yeah.
Right. Awesome. I'd like to just go out on the song, but if you want to preface it at all, I'm going to play Bombs Above. By the way, I loved the sound of your voice on this record was quite extraordinary, and specifically this song. Was there anything before you went in to record this song, Bombs Above? Is there anything different you had feeling-wise?
Well, you know, the interesting thing that kind of ties into NPR about this song is that I've had a version, actually this same version of it was recorded for a while. I've had it maybe for a couple of years. And the vocal was, that always kind of bothered me because it was in an octave below, a lower register. It was more conversational. And it always sounded a little bit lower energy than what I felt was...
You mean it sounded like NPR?
No, here's the NPR part. That's okay, not the okay. NPR part. Yeah. It didn't sound like a... Yeah. Oh, never mind. But I was asked to perform at your anniversary in D.C.
Right. NPR Music Tent.
And I played this song, and it was the first time I ever played it in front of people. And because I was playing in front of a big crowd, I sang it an octave higher because it felt like it had to be, I couldn't really sing it over the music in the lower register, and I wanted it to be more urgent sounding. And I came home from that, and I re-recorded it, the vocal in that register.
Oh, well, yeah. I love it, and I think... For anyone, well, first read the book, but I think when you hear it, you made this entire album, I assume you made this album warm with freshly having written the book and thinking about what's going on. I'm making an assumption, but...
Well, I was given 2 years to write the book, and a lot of these songs have been worked on throughout that whole process. They ended up getting grouped together from the stuff that I'm always recording. There are dozens and dozens of recordings started at almost any given time at the loft where I go every day. So these are the songs that I finished towards the end of the process of finishing my book. And for lyric writing, I was definitely trying to stay in a more clear and concise form of, I was like almost writing prose, I felt like, for the first time in my life in my lyrics, because I had to get over a fear of writing prose to write the book. So I don't know if this ended up having some deeper connection than I anticipated. And that's, you know, they end up coming out around the same time. So they definitely, I feel like they're companions.
Yeah, they feel like part of a family. Thanks for this. I really appreciate your time today. Give my love to Spencer and your family. Be well.
I will. Good talking to you.
Yeah, likewise.
Thanks.
Jeff Tweedy's new album's called Warm. The book is called Let's Go So We Can Get Back, a memoir of recording and discording with Wilco, etc. I'm Bob Boylan for NPR Music. It's All Songs Considered.
Was wrong to agree.